This episode is supported in part by the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, advocating for healthy communities and a sustainable Gulf Coast.
Welcome to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform, with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. Today, we're going to be talking about expertise and government. Now, the so-called technocracy gets a bad rap until, of course, there's news of pollution in your drinking water or a rapidly expanding virus, let's say, and then you want specialists in charge. The trouble is everything's getting so politically polarized that science and other forms of expertise keep getting bent out of shape to suit political ideologies. Climate science, of course, is the poster child of this. There's something like a 40-point difference between Democrats and Republicans on whether or not they accept the basic idea that human emissions are driving climate disruption. But now it looks like even flu science is susceptible to this. We have surveys, for instance, showing that for years, Republicans have been less likely to accept vaccines for flu, for instance, like the swine flu of years earlier, than Democrats are. And of course, we're seeing that the COVID-19 virus is also being sort of subjected to a left-right debate, with Democrats demanding that the virus be treated like an important threat that it is, and Republicans minimizing it, insisting that the Democrats are just blowing up this issue for some kind of political gain. But this isn't just about climate science or the COVID-19 virus. This issue about expertise in government and putting specialists in charge when they need to be in charge is an issue that goes across the government, and it's been that way for decades. And today we have two guests who are going to help us understand a little bit how expertise is used in federal agencies and why it's so important that expertise be protected from political influence. Luckily, we have two experts, and yes, we're proud of that, who have written on this subject. They've just finished a draft of their book called Reimagining Administrative Law, and they are seeking to find out how exactly agencies in the United States government can make sure that the specialists and the expertise who are developing policy in agencies can be free to do that and have their decisions protected in order to protect the American people and our environment as well. Those two authors are Liz Fisher. She's a professor of environmental law at Oxford University and an expert in U.S. environmental and regulatory law. Sid is the Frank Fletcher Chair in Administrative Law at Wake Forest University. And he's a leading expert also in administrative procedure in the United States and a member of the board of the Center for Progressive Reform. I caught up with them a few days ago on an internet conference line. Both of them, by the way, were in the UK at the time. And I was at Connect the Dots headquarters in New Orleans. Here's the interview. Liz and Sid, welcome to Connect the Dots. I want to start by asking you both a question about how the United States government is handling the coronavirus. We're recording this on March 3rd, and as of this date, there have been 100 confirmed cases of the virus in the United States and 6 deaths resulting. I'm wondering, Sid, in what ways you think that the agencies are best deploying the skills of their experts in this context, and in what ways do you think that they are failing?
My general perception, Rob, as a visitor in England for this year, I'm on an academic visit, is that the government here is taking advice of its senior scientists and other people who know how to deal with these kinds of diseases. But it's also chafing a bit at the advice it's receiving, because some of the warnings here, like in the States, are fairly dire, and they come at a very bad time for this country because the economy apparently is going to take a fairly major hit from Brexit anyway, and they may be sitting on even more bad economic news as a result of the virus. All that said, I think they're consulting, and their problem is that over the years, as part of the budget cutting of the conservative governments, they've robbed agencies of a lot of the resources they need to deal with this. The police are down. The health service is missing a lot of money that it previously had. And so while they're not as dismissive of expertise as apparently is happening in the United States, they also didn't want to pay for it. And so they may be in somewhat the same position.
Yeah, that's interesting because in the U.S., we're hearing news that the Centers of Disease Control, for instance, have lost a number of experts during the Trump administration, I think, as part of cutting budgets, and particularly experts interested in pandemics, for instance. And the national security infrastructure in the United States was similarly cut, pared down, particularly in the areas of responding to pandemics. And so all of that is sort of raising questions about what sort of expertise is available to us. What does this say about the importance of expertise in agencies, particularly when that expertise is related to things that are really important, but not always important? So for instance, preparation for a pandemic might fit that description. When there's no pandemic, it doesn't seem so important. But then when you have one, it seems like the most vital thing that government is doing.
So I think it's a great question because it highlights that the type of collective action problems that you have with a pandemic, or if you think about trying to respond to climate change, or something like water or air pollution, is that you need a role for government. And part of that role is expert capacity. And that capacity is both about providing information, but also coordinating a response to it. And it's very easy, I think, to sort of demonize sort of expertise in government. We talk about technocrats, we talk about bureaucrats as if they're slightly, you know, kind of dubious people. But it is this capacity that governments need to respond to these problems. And that response is not only important because of people's lives, but also, as Sid was highlighting in relation to the UK, also important in relation to the economy and other things. So, I mean, so then sort of moving on from that, that expertise is not just a single expertise. So your point about pandemics, mm-hmm. Yes, we need people to know about pandemics, but we also need, in relation to the coronavirus, people who know about how do you communicate public health information to a large population, how you need experts to be thinking about how to mobilize the public health service. You need experts who are thinking about how populations move between different areas and so on. And you need someone to coordinate those different types of expertise.
Well, and I assume also you need, I mean, here in the U.S., there's been a discussion that President Trump, for instance, may have been concerned about the state of the economy and the state of the stock market when information was being revealed about the coronavirus. And, you know, being generous with that interpretation, I suppose you could say, well, that's part of American welfare, too, is the state of the economy, the state of investments. And it's important that people don't overreact, as sometimes communities do, to news about pandemics. And so how do you balance, I mean, if we take a look at sort of expertise as being, well, we're interested in how our economy is functioning, we're interested in how people are communicated to, we're interested in how our mass transit and airlines will function efficiently, and we're interested in public health. How does government go about balancing all of those kinds of expertise, which might cut in different directions depending upon what kind of an expert you are?
One of the things that we hope to do in the book is, as Liz was just explaining, there are multiple types of expertises, including an expertise in coordinating the expertise.
Right.
but there's something else there that lies underneath all that.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Which is a kind of deep experience in making these judgments. As you were just suggesting, these matters of public policy have all kinds of conflicts. The science is incomplete. We don't know yet, for example, just how dangerous this virus might be. You have to factor in the resources of the public health service. You have to factor in the politics, the communication. And people need to do that and figure out a pathway through all the conflict and all the contributing expertises and all the information that's available. And that's not a very easy task. And the only way to do it comes with doing it before. You build up this kind of expertise. And when we have a competent agency and a competent government, what that means is that we have generations of experts who have gone through this or gone through something similar. And they can help the political appointees see pathways through that best balance as well as we can all these competing considerations. As one senior civil servant once told me, there's always a tension because the matters are complicated, and sometimes you have to take in factors as a elected official you don't really want to take into account. But there's two ways of approaching that. You can either ignore the expertise and just bull ahead, or you can go to your senior civil servants and tell them what you want to do, and they'll help you try to find the path that's closest to your political objectives. And I think it's that senior experience that we're really missing in the United States, and it looks like some of that may be missing here as well.
Your book is titled Administrative Competence. What makes an administration, what makes an agency competent in your view? What are the elements involved, and where does expertise fit into that?
So it really has two aspects. So if we think about a dictionary definition of competence, there are two ways to define it. One is someone is competent because they have the ability to do something. And this we call capacity. We set up administrative agencies to do things. They have legislative mandates. If we take the EPA, it's meant to deliver clean water or set standards for clean water, for clean air, and so on. The other aspect of competence is that someone, their power is fit and proper. That we might think of as that they're acting within their they're acting within their power. So our argument is for government to be competent, it both needs capacity and it also needs to be a proper exercise of power. Now, our argument would be that administrative lawyers have focused too much on the second form of competence as a sort of limits to power and not enough on thinking about the capacity of public administration and how administrative law can contribute to that capacity.
So that's interesting because, I teach about administrative law and regulatory law. Yeah, it does seem that so many in the United States anyway, so many of the legal disputes that we dwell on have to do with whether an agency, as we'd say in the U.S., is staying in its lane. We talk about separation of powers between the executive branch and the legislative branch and the judicial branch. We talk about federalism, the relationship between what a state should be doing and what the federal government should be doing. Can you tell me more about how law influences the capacity part? Because I find, just talking to everyday, people in everyday settings, and even talking to my law students, that a number of them seem to not know as much about what happens inside the building of an agency, who's there, and how they're expertise and talents are arranged. Sid, what can you tell us a little bit about that, about how the law influences the capacity part of agencies?
Well, Rob, I could be cheeky, as they say over here, and just say, wait for the book.
Yeah.
You've offered us this wonderful opportunity to talk about expertise, and I'd be happy to address your question.
Yeah, this is a spoiler alert, I guess. Go ahead.
That's right. Shucks, there went another sale. There's a number of ways, and some of them are a little complicated, but one obvious way is that we ensure that agencies are staying in their lane by allowing people who are not satisfied with the agency decision to appeal it to federal judges, this independent judiciary that can judge for themselves outside of politics whether or not the agency, in fact, has exceeded its legal authority. Now, that's a somewhat complicated process, but in doing that, we need to take into account, as we come up with legal doctrines, this dual idea of capacity, which Liz just spoke about. And so judges have some discretion as to how the law gets applied to agencies. And if they don't have in mind that when they make these judgments about what it means that an agency is staying in its lane, if they don't have in mind that they need to preserve the capacity end of competence as well as the restraint end of competence, then little by little, the ability of expertise to contribute and make a good administrative law decision gets lost. And those are judgment calls, and judges will disagree about how to do that. But one of the key points in our book is that the point about capacity, the point about agencies actually delivering on what they're supposed to do, actually protecting the public as best they can against the virus, that's just not even in the judge's thinking too many times when he or she goes to apply the law. And it's really out of sight, out of mind. And that's what we want to bring back to administrative law is this dual understanding of capacity.
So just following on from that, and to use your rather wonderful analogy of kind of staying inside the lane, if we think about sort of saying to someone, we want you to stay inside the lane, we also have certain expectations about how they're going to behave in the lane. So, you know, if they're in the lane on a freeway and crawling along at 5 miles per hour, we would sort of say, well, actually, that's not.
Oh, I like that.
That's, you know, that's not on. You know, you might be in the lane, but you're actually not doing what is expected of a car on the freeway. And so when we come to administrative agencies, it's not just that we expect them to, you know, act within their power. There are also certain expectations about how that power should be exercised. And there are some judges who don't think about this, but there are far more judges and lawyers who have implicit assumptions about the expertise of decision makers, which by making them explicit, actually administrative law doctrine would be more robust. And sort of building on that, one of the big arguments of the book is that administrative lawyers tend to have too thin an understanding of expertise. They either think it's sort of objective science or they think it's just politics. And really what we're doing is we're saying, no, it's all these complex practices, like the stuff that we just talked about in regards to coronavirus. And it's those practices that really we need to sort of think about as administrative law and develop our doctrine around. I'm sure Sid has some points to add to that.
Well, let me ask quickly, Sid, can you give me an example of an agency that you think is managing its capacity in a really good way? Or maybe give me an example of an agency that you think is failing in this way so we can sort of think of it in a concrete way.
Well, at the moment, and unfortunately because of the Trump administration, and its disconnect from expertise, it's hard to find examples of agencies implementing good public policies by applying their expertise, because the administration has at every turn sought to either not listen or bypass the science and just ignore it, or get rid of the scientists because they're seeking political outcomes that are just not supported by expertise. And if there were more experts around to point that out, then they wouldn't have as easy path trying to do what they want to do as they might otherwise. So what happens is that when agencies want to act, they can't just act. They have to give reasons for what they do, and people have the opportunity to challenge those reasons. And the more robust that process is in terms of expertise, the better decisions we get made. And when it's a kind of thin process, then a lot can go wrong and you can reach erroneous decisions, or at least not as good a decisions as you might have otherwise. So maybe that's the underpowered car that gets on the freeway, but it's been throttled back and not allowed to run at 65 miles an hour or 75. It can only run at 20.
So, and I think that comment highlights the fact that, you know, one of the great achievements of the American polity is the building up of administrative agencies that do have competence. I mean, if you look at the expertise which has been built up over time and is now being eroded under the Trump administration in the EPA, it's very impressive. But where we're really seeing the problems, I think, are in relation to particular decisions. So an example I would give is the waters of the United States, which has been, you know, very politically contested. What are the waters of the United States, which will define the jurisdictional scope of the Clean Water Act? The Obama administration passed a rule which was based on a huge amount of kind of scientific analysis of this quite tricky issue. You know, what are the waters of the United States? You can't go out there and there be little labels. It's an ecological question, a hydrological question. The most recent sort of, you know, rule published by the Trump administration grounds it on a judicial precedent. And I think that reflects a problem with expertise, because a judicial precedent about a hydrological phenomena, there is a mismatch there. And that would, Sid, you go ahead.
Rob, yeah, I was just going to extend that a bit for the listener. Waters of the United States comes up under the Clean Water Act, mm-hmm. And EPA has the responsibility for trying to prevent various dangerous kinds of pollutants from getting in our water. And there's a problem in the agricultural sector because farmers use lots of pesticides. And then when it rains, those pesticides can sweep into the water, and eventually we ended up drinking it, animals end up drinking it. It actually harms the water itself, and therefore the ecology of the water is adversely affected. And the question is, how do those pollutants get into the water? And there's a number of pieces of land that are connected or nearby streams and rivers, but they're only wet some of the time. There may be even dry gullies that, when it rains really hard, fill up with water. So the question in protecting the land for EPA is, when is it likely that harmful chemicals will get swept into streams and rivers and do harm from drier areas of the country that nevertheless are wet some of the time and can be harmful? And as Liz just suggested, that's an intensely complicated scientific question. But to those resisting regulation, which is some of the farm community and the Trump administration, they don't really want to know the answer. They want to cut off regulation and make it possible to continue using all these chemicals to a much greater degree.
So what would you, and let me just, if I can, try to add to the complexity a little bit, because as my listeners know, I have in the first term of the Obama administration, I was a political appointee at EPA. And in fact, way back then, we were in discussions about how we might issue some kind of a rule, or at that time we were even thinking about a guideline having to do with the waters of the United States. And we were looking a lot, as you say, Sid, about scientific information and hydrological connections. We also had another group of experts at the EPA who were looking at the legal decisions that had come down from the U.S. Supreme Court and trying to figure out, okay, in addition to what the science might say, what is it that the courts are saying about how the Clean Water Act was intended by Congress to operate, right? And so we were looking, and of course, there were other areas of expertise, too, that we were looking at, but let's just take that sort of legal expertise and scientific expertise. Now, I'm assuming that the Trump administration is concerned not just about, to the degree they're concerned about the scientific information, they're also concerned about what they think the legal capacity or authority is. And we might all three of us disagree about what their understanding of the legal authority or their understanding of the policy basis of protecting water pollution. But how do you, I guess what I'm wondering is, Sid, are you saying, or Liz, are you saying that that the ideal situation would be for a court to more to more deeply probe the decisions that the experts are making with within the EPA? And if you're saying that, what makes a judge particularly good at being able to probe the appropriateness of the scientific expertise or the economic expertise or the historical expertise that's being brought to bear?
So just to kind of step back from your question, which is a really important question, which is, you know, in making a decision about what waters of the United States, as you quite rightly point out, it's going to involve a mixture of different forms of expertise. And if you look at the Obama rule on waters of the United States, it did also recognize the case law of the Supreme Court on this, which, as I'm sure you know, is not particularly clear cut.
Yes, right.
So I think that's, you know, it's not that it's the science versus the law. It's about recognizing how are these different things combined to come up with a coherent, properly reasoned rule. The new rule proposed by the Trump administration really sort of favors the legal in defining this hydrological question. So that's my first point. My second point in relation to how should a court review this? You're absolutely right that courts are generalist courts. They have no expertise in the science. But they do have expertise in accountability. And what we look at in the book is how courts, in understanding what it is that should be expected of the expert capacity of an administrative agency, can use those expectations to guide their review of the reasoning of the agency. So I think it's important to recognize in these cases that agencies don't just declare things. As you know, they write many hundreds of pages
yes,
of explanations
right.
about what they're doing, and that is what the court is reviewing. But they need some guidance of what they should be looking for and what are good examples of reasoning and bad examples of reasoning.
We can relate this to what we were discussing earlier as listeners may recall, we said that one of the flaws of administrative law as we now see it is that there are judges and lawyers who, when they're looking at the question of an agency's competence, consider only the legality They're only interested in drawing a line around what the agency can and cannot do, and drawing that line in a way that limits the agency's authority, so we have smaller government, not larger government. And what we're talking about now is a really good example. When we say that the Trump administration is basing this on legal authority, what we mean is they're looking for ways to limit the amount of land that the EPA rule might cover. And their objective there is solely to limit EPA's ability to regulate. It's a very much an anti-regulatory objective, protect the farm community from EPA regulation. And as we were explaining the difficulty of that, sole focus on legality, is it's going to miss lands that in fact contribute significantly to pollution in the nation's waters. And by ignoring what the experts have to bring to this, that's the consequence. And that's not a competent decision, because part of EPA's capacity is protecting us from that pollution and protecting nature from that pollution. And that has to be part of the decision as well. So then what happens properly is a judge will look for both in these extensive explanations, as Liz was just explaining.
Go ahead, so this is really defined as a matter of statutory interpretation. You know, how in the Clean Waters Act do you define waters of the United States? And of course, the ruling doctrine is the Chevron doctrine, which says, well, if the legislation is clear on its face, you give it that interpretation. Otherwise, you defer to the agency's interpretation so long as it's a reasonable interpretation. Now, in figuring out what is a reasonable interpretation, a court is going to have to make some assumptions about what they think the expertise of that administrative agency is. So if they see it as an expertise which involves, you know, these multitude of different types of disciplines coming to bear on a problem, that's going to be very different than if they think an expert agency is a little bit like a computer where you type in the question and an answer spits out.
Is there a role for... I want to get back to the idea, though, that you might have plausible arguments on either side for an expert-driven decision, and it seems to me that you're asking the courts to take a more active role in deciding what's a better expert-driven decision than another. Am I right about that?
Not quite.
Okay, so tell me why not.
You got us both excited by your question, Ron.
Yeah, so the first point is that it is inevitable there are going to be judgment calls. They're inevitable that there is a decision has to be made one way or the other. And in that regard, it is important to remember that a court in judicial review is not completely remaking the decision, that they're checking it for its legal validity.
Mm-hmm.
But the second point is in a sense, in resolving those cases where you could go one way or the other, what is actually going to be crucial is what are the assumptions you think about what it is that public administration does. So one of the things we do in the book is we look at some of the kind of high-profile cases about Chevron where there was a split in the Supreme Court, and show that the difference between the dissent and the majority is usually about the assumptions about public administration.
Oh, can you give me an example of that?
I think we see maybe one here, if I might. A court has this dual role of checking on the administrative competence. Is this decision competent in terms of expertise? And checking the legal competence. And while that's kind of complicated by the case law, what it really comes down to with the Waters case is if a judge were operating in the manner that we prefer, he or she would look at the entire record, recognizing that what is a water of the United States is a complicated scientific and legal decision.
Sure.
And would ask, well, did the Trump administration have some competence on their side, some expertise on their side for this rather limited or cramped view of what constitutes a water? And if, in fact, the experts are split, if we're talking about sort of competing understandings of how far out the regulation has to go, how much it has to go into this sometimes dry land, then the court will say, well, it's a complicated decision. Somebody has to be in charge. For better or worse, we elected the Trump administration to do that right now, and they get to make the call. What we hope the court would also do is say, in making that call, the Trump administration needs to have expertise on its side. And by not even pretending that this decision was connected to expertise, only making it a kind of, we want to cut down on EPA's authority decision, they haven't brought any expertise really to bear on this issue. And so we hope that a judge properly will strike that down, because this isn't a close question.
So another example is a case which involved the Supreme Court reviewing the EPA's decision about how to handle a provision of the Clean Air Act, which was to do with a kind of good neighbor provision. And this deals with how do you calculate the kind of burden on an upwind state for the pollution in a downwind state. And what you see is the majority, Ginsburg's judgment there, she understands that in making this decision, the EPA is crafting a response to deal with this problem. They're taking a lot into account. In this case, she felt that they kind of reasoned it through in a proper and appropriate and reasonable way, and they upheld their interpretation. In contrast, Scalia says, well, this is just an exercise in number crunching. That's the language he uses, you know, and they should have just crunched the numbers and there's nothing else for them to consider in their expertise. So that's another, one could argue that's another way to view their expertise, but therefore for him, the interpretation that the EPA gave the Clean Air Act was not, you know, was not actually reasonable. So it's that what we think the EPA is meant to be doing is going to shape how we think they should be interpreting the law.
Liz Fisher made a great distinction between what an agency should be doing and how it should be doing it. I'm going to ask her a question about that, but first, let's take a break. I just wanted to call your attention to another great media offering we have at CPR, and that is the CPR blog post. You can find that at progressivereform.org. And we have some of our best scholars, some of the best scholars in the United States on the left of center, writing about environmental and public protection issues. For instance, John Leschi asking whether or not Secretary Bernhardt actually has a duty to fight climate change. Spoiler alert, yes, he does. Karen Sokol points out the problem with the Climate Leadership Council's carbon tax plan. David Dreesen is asking in one of his posts whether the Supreme Court will create a pathway to autocracy in a consumer protection agency case. And Noah Sachs brings up an argument analysis that he titles The Trail, The Pipeline, and a Journey to the Center of the Earth. And if you've ever hiked and loved the Appalachian Trail, you're going to be interested in that one. Okay, let's get back to my interview, where I will ask Liz Fisher more about that distinction between what agencies should be doing and how they should be doing it. So you're very interested in the aspect of how, which is, I suppose, an indicator of the capacity of an agency and how it's using it. And so
If I've got it right, I think that then what you're saying is, so a court might look and say, well, did you look at the right studies? Did you, or did you look at studies that are on the right topics? Did you consider studies that looked at hydrology? Did you consider studies that looked at how streams form in certain seasons rather than others? And if you've looked at the information and done a plausible job at that, as opposed to just saying we crunched the numbers or we ran the computer model and got this this number, and you have to trust us. Is that right? That you want, you don't expect them to know what the right, you don't expect the judge to know what the right scientific answer is, but you do expect the judge to know what a robust investigation of scientific evidence looks like.
That's right. And so in another part of the book, we look at the debate over hard look review, which you may have come across this term in the 1970s, which was courts that were judicially reviewing expert decisions said, well, we're not experts ourselves. So we can't, you know, this is quite a challenging task for us. But what we can expect is that the decision maker will take a hard look at the issue. And so in conducting judicial review, that's exactly what we're going to demand of them. They need to show us that they've taken a hard look at the issue. Now, of course, the key question is, well, what does it mean to take a hard look at the issue? And different judges varied on that. Sorry. Sorry about that. Different judges took different views on that. I don't know if, Sid, you want to come in here.
I was just going to try to maybe tie this to a broader issue, which is how judges and we the public think about the legitimacy of an agency. And there are those folks who are more conservative.
I teach a case.
Who are very much concerned about the power that an agency has, because after all, it doesn't operate within the normal separation of powers confines of our government. So when we speak of the fourth branch of government, people who use that term often mean that not as a compliment. They mean, here's a branch of government with all this awesome power over the American economy and the public. And we're really concerned that they're going to use that power very badly. So we've got to figure out a way to avoid that. And one way to do that, as we see in the Trump administration, is to try to change a four-lane road into a two-lane road. Just they'll have less power, and therefore they can use less damage. But the power of an agency is not only how much authority does it have, it's also, is it able to do what Congress wanted it to do? Is it able to protect us from the virus? Is it able to give us clean water? Is it able to give us clean air? Both that has to come into consideration, too. You can't just look at the power of agencies and say, oh, they have a lot of power. We got to do something about that, because they need that power in order to be able to protect us. So when a judge goes into the hard look doctrine, that's what a very useful way of asking how well they use their power. Do they use it in a legitimate fashion, or is this a kind of autocratic decision and the very kind of decision that we should be afraid of because of the lack of accountability? And the way to do that, as Liz just described, is say, well, they claim they're doing this. It's necessary to reach out and assert their power because of expertise. So we need to take a look at that expertise and make sure, in fact, they've done a good job of using their expertise. And if we see signs that they may not have done that, then we can say to the agency, well, maybe you can do this, but we're going to send it back because we just don't quite understand how your expertise supports this decision. And why don't you explain it to us again and make it clear how expertise led you to this decision? Now, in some cases, like the Waters rule, what we're hoping, as said, is they'll look at this and they'll say, well, it's not a matter of how did you use your expertise. It appears you didn't use it at all.
Right.
And so that's really a kind of illegitimate decision, because while that may well mean the agency has less power and less authority, it also means it's not going to be able to protect us. And so it's not legitimate if you only look at one thing and then rob us of the very thing the agency is supposed to be doing.
One of the things that worries me, for instance, just yesterday, on March 2nd in the New York Times, there was a headline, "A Trump Insider Embeds Climate Denial in Scientific Research." And essentially, it's a story about the Department of Interior, which is engaged in various environmental assessments having to do with water scarcity in the West, which is going to influence things like the removal of dams on the Deschutes River and the Klamath and so on. And according to the story, there is a particular, one takes it an outlier scientist within the Department of Interior whose work questioning climate science is now suddenly being elevated. And a lot of his idiosyncratic, we will say, conclusions about climate change are being elevated and now inserted into these environmental assessments. And then you have, you know, other scientists alleging in the newspaper article saying that this particular activity that I just described is taking very, taking very specific isolated pieces of science and trying to expand them in an extraordinarily misleading fashion. So here's what I'm seeing from this, and I want to get your reaction, is that, accepting this report as accurate here, the situation seems to be that the agency, the Department of Interior, is taking outlier scientific information that unduly minimizes the threat of climate change and weaving it into these environmental assessments to support political conclusions that in this case would be helpful to farmers, but not helpful to preservation of endangered species. But this sounds a lot harder for a court, for instance, to smoke out, because what I'm assuming is you might look at this environmental assessment and you'd say, not that there isn't science that's being cited, but that it's outlier science that's being cited, or it's manipulated science that is being cited. And I would think that that would be a harder thing for a court or perhaps anyone to detect.
So I think there's two things. First of all, and we outlined this in the book, is that it needs to be recognized that expertise comes with its own form of accountability processes. They don't displace the law, but they operate within and outside public administration. Mm-hmm. And so the example you give recognizes the importance, for example, of peer review.
Yes, right.
And the need that an administrative agency isn't sort of like a citadel that nobody can kind of get in. It is really important that an agency has connections with wider disciplines and wider debates. As I remember, one person who worked in the EPA said to me, you know, he was often thinking about way out there accountability. And what he meant was that his decisions, he felt he was always needing to be accountable to the wider, you know, scientific community. Mm-hmm. And that they would have. So that's the first bit. And then the second bit is that in courts reviewing these, in a sense, it's an agency needing to explain why they have taken this approach. Now, it may be that judicial review is not the forum to resolve that question, but judicial review, and this is one of the other things we kind of highlight in the book, how does that connect up with those scientific peer review processes as well. And as I said, those peer review processes don't displace law, but it is something in a reviewing court looking, well, you know, is this peer-reviewed science or not, would be a simple question.
Right.
There's a third bit, which is this. Administrative law has long actually been concerned about this issue. And what we've done is develop in rulemaking a process of testing ideas, another kind of peer review. It's not scientific peer review, but it is a kind of legal peer review, where people can file comments in the rulemaking record. And so what often happens, and has happened to the Trump administration with some regularity, is environmental groups and others upset over a proposed decision, like this one that you just mentioned, Rob, will file comments, and they will say to the court, by putting it in the record, which the court will see, hey, you're cherry-picking the science. This is not legitimate science. You've ignored all these studies. You haven't spoke about these other studies. This is a bad methodology. It doesn't reflect this. It doesn't reflect that. And once those comments are in the record, there's an expectation, a judicial expectation, that an agency will give a response to it. They have to have an adequate response as to why, in fact, they didn't cook the scientific evidence just the way that the commentators are asserting. And in that way, we get a kind of check. It's also kind of process of expertise. You don't normally think of it that way, but it is a kind of process of expertise to hopefully keep this kind of scientific shenanigans down to a minimum. The difficulty with the Trump administration is that they've done this in so many areas at so many agencies that they've really stretched out the resources of the environmental groups to get in there and comment and use their own expertise of climate change to say, look, we also know a lot about climate change. We also have experts out here. In academia and in our own organization. And here's what you missed, and here's what you didn't do competently. So hopefully our brothers and sisters in the environmental movement will also be all over this one, and eventually it'll get kicked back by the courts because the Trump administration is not going to be able to answer those accusations successfully that they didn't cook the scientific information.
But I think in all of this, what's fundamental is to understand the complexity of expertise. So there is a danger, you know, So in all of this, it's important to understand the complexity of expertise. And really what our book is grounded in is giving this thicker understanding of expertise as a kind of practical reason. And that's important because what we're arguing for is we need to recognise expertise, but we need to recognise that it's accountable. And of course, you can have too much of accountability. So if we go back to the sort of 1980s, 1990s, there was an argument of a lot of administrative lawyers that, you know, any flaw in the scientific reasoning of a decision could be used as a reason to say that it was legally invalid.
About the banning of asbestos years back.
Corrosion proof.
Yes, where the EPA had created this extremely long record, hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents, years and years in the making, and then the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals basically nitpicked over and over and said, "Well, you haven't justified your ability to ban asbestos, which we know is a toxic product." And when I was at EPA, it was interesting because when we would have discussions about EPA's authority to ban extremely dangerous products, it was clear we had the legal authority to do that, but there was no appetite anywhere within the agency to exercise that particular authority because of that one case, because you know everybody in the building would just say, "Oh, it's not worth it. You'll spend 10 years and you'll lose because the court will nitpick your decision."
And we would argue a lot of that nitpicking comes about because there's a failure to understand what is it that we should expect of expert capacity.
Yes, I agree with
that. It's not a computer. It is about, you know, a range of different forms of expertise. So, and that's really where we're reimagining administrative law. So we begin the book by noting that administrative law is caught in this rather depressing binary. You're either for controlling public administration or you're for saying, oh, no, we should let it do what it wants to
exactly,
do.
Exactly, right.
And that is such a depressing choice because neither, you know, neither is particularly appealing. If we control public administration too much, it can't do what is expected of it. But on the other hand, nobody wants to say to public administration, you can do what you like, because that way danger lies. And what we're really showing is by bringing in this idea of competence and capacity, you can begin to see a true law of public administration where you're ensuring it stays within proper boundaries, but you're also building a body of law which recognises its expertise and what we expect of its expertise.
Rob, you're correct that the case we're just describing is a good example of what Liz was just saying. If as a judge, your primary, maybe even exclusive concern is the possibility of these autocratic agencies over-regulating the American economy, then when you look at what EPA did, and you find a few mistakes, which were pointed out by the asbestos manufacturers, and not understanding the nature of expertise, which is that it's never going to be perfect, you say to yourself, well, before I allow them to assert all this power, they're going to have to get it perfect. And that's just misunderstanding the process and not caring about the protection of the American public. Only caring about, I got to find ways to cut down on the power of administrative government. And that's just not a good thing in the end for the rest of us.
I want to ask a question, a broad question, really, that many of us are experiencing in the, or that's related to a phenomenon many of us are experiencing in the Trump administration, I think, which is what I'll just phrase as the war on truth or the war on facts. I mean, so much of what we have been seeing in the rhetoric of the Trump administration, to my mind, seems designed to suggest to people that there is no truth or that there are no real widely shared facts that we can agree on. And I wonder if that isn't also trickling into the public's idea of science. You know, Liz brought this up earlier, and it is, this is not new with the Trump administration, but the idea that I think a lot of people, lay people, look at technology and look at scientists, and they probably think, well, you could find an expert who would say anything. Right. And the science is complicated. You know, we've gone back and forth of whether it's OK to eat butter, you know, as a health, as a matter of public health. And so we go back and forth and science is just tremendously uncertain. And it seems to me that Trump has just sort of brought this to the 10th power by saying, you know, everything is tremendously uncertain and you can't trust anything except for your ideology, or except for your sort of emotive feelings about a particular issue, and you should just run with that instead. What do you think about the context of the argument? I mean, you're essentially arguing, right, which I think is exactly right, is that science and administrative capacity is very complicated. We have to acknowledge its complexity. We have to make room for that complexity and also hold it accountable for thinking in this sort of multifaceted, complex way. But at the end of the day, it seems to me that that is an argument that's extremely hard for lay people to A, understand, perhaps, or B, accept, because it's... we have so much relativism now in politics and even in our own public discourse.
So the French thinker Bruno Latour sort of says, you know, the question is not whether something is true or false, which sort of sounds very postmodern. But the point he makes next is a really important one. The question is how well or badly constructed is something? So in thinking about authority and what has authority within our democracies, it's looking at, well, how was this truth established? You know, did someone just make it up, or were there these careful studies, etc.? And I think while that's not something that public debate is focusing a lot on at the moment, most people in their daily lives, when they're deciding about who to trust, who to rely on, they are looking at these questions about, well, what, you know, how did they come up with their conclusions, etc.? So I think that's my first point. The second point is that the American Constitution is an Enlightenment constitution. It is based both on a commitment to democracy, but also in a sense to science and public reason. And that's where the role of public administration comes in. And it's been there since the earliest time and since the founding period, you know, to offer capacity in government. So in thinking about this, you know, the importance of kind of truth and authority, it is about recognizing that this has a very, you know, it's an old vintage. Sid?
This goes back, I agree with everything that just was said, but I also want to add this. This goes back to something that was mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation by Liz, I think, which is that these various scientific disciplines have methodologies to sort out good ideas, good insights from ones that turn out to be erroneous impressions of what's going on in the world. One of those is peer review, as we were just talking about. Another is establishing norms of professionalism among scientists, among physicians, among ecologists, among economists, where you understand that you have to come to understand the world by honoring and following how your discipline sorts out what is true and not true. And all that's going on. It's still going on. It's very important. And it does produce trustworthy information. So what's happened? Well, it used to be that the public had a high trust that process. It wasn't understood much, but there was a sort of vague understanding that these are smart people and they have a way of doing this. And as a general matter, they have no reason to come up with bad ideas. A doctor wants to cure you, not harm you. So I'll trust that process. And as we all know from public opinion polls, that trust is going down. It's going down across the board. But in particular, that trust in government is, I think, at an all-time low. So how is it at one time the American public had sufficient trust in government that it was doing things the right way and therefore producing reasonable decisions? And how is it that trust was lost? And my own view outside of the book is that this has been a steady campaign against government by those who prefer small government, who are anti-government, to delegitimize the government by saying you can't trust it and making fun of it and saying it's all about a power grab and it's the deep state operating to rob the American public of its country and conspiracy theories. And all of that gradually has deteriorated our trust in government. And that has opened the door for President Trump and others to simply make up facts to support what they want to do. And the public just says, well, I guess you can't trust anybody. We'll go with this guy. The other aspect of it is, over the years, those who want smaller government have gradually defunded the government. And we were talking about that at the start of the program, both here in Great Britain and in America, so that the government's capacity, its expert capacity, has been eroded by lack of money and resources. And as a result of that, and ironically, as a result of the various roadblocks that conservatives have created, government is less good at protecting the American public than it used to be. It's still a pretty good deal for the American public, but it's less good than it used to be. And so this is a kind of back doorway that people opposed to government have made their distrust of government have built support for that by looking for ways to make the government less competent. Because by doing that, then the public doesn't trust this process, which is very hard to understand the way that they really should.
I have to say, Sid, this is a really scary insight, I think, to me. And, you know, I think, just to give you an idea sort of what how I'm thinking about this, I've traveled and lived in developing countries that didn't necessarily, some of them weren't democracies and some of them were kind of authoritarian. And one of the things that you notice when you're living in a country like that, even for a short period of time, is the amount of distrust people have for their government. I mean, you read a headline in a newspaper and nobody reads that headline as necessarily reflecting what's true, because they know that the government might have had a hand in promoting that particular headline. Or if the government says, oh, well, you should be doing such and so in order to protect yourself from a virus, the first reaction would be, well, I wonder if that's really true. Or, you know, now in the age of the internet, you'd say, well, I'm going to go on the WHO website, the UN's website, and make sure that's true, you know, as opposed to just listening to what my government leader is saying. And I notice that a lot in many developing countries around the world where there's a lot of corruption or where the rule of law is not especially strong. And when I was in those countries, you would become a little complacent about that. But I would always think, oh, well, you know, I live in a country, I'm a citizen of a country, the United States, where that isn't true. You know, sure, sometimes people doubt their political leaders, or sure, sometimes people don't always trust what they read in the newspaper. But by and large, I always thought that we lived in a country where you could, you know, read the headlines of a newspaper and assume that it was, you know, most likely true. And that if somebody at the Centers for Disease Control told you to wear a mask or not to wear a mask or to wash your hands, that was something that, like you say, Sid, there was no reason to doubt. But I wonder if this general phenomenon that you're describing, Sid, is really leading to a lasting change, to where we might not actually look at the U.S. government in the same way again. So I guess part of I'm sort of wondering what your reaction is to that. And also, I guess the follow-up question is, how do we regain trust in government? I mean, if I'm feeling this in the United States, what is it going to take to change my attitude or the attitude of other people who share those thoughts?
So the book ends on a very hopeful note.
Oh, good.
And it's hopeful in two ways. You know, there have been, you know, dark moments in American administrative history. So think about the problems created by the patronage system in the sort of mid to late 19th century, where in a sense, you know, each political party, you could basically buy a post within administrative government. And by the 1870s, it was appreciated that this was a disaster. And then you see legislative reform with the Pendleton Act, which introduces the idea of merit-based appointment to civil service posts. And so at the end of the book, we argue in a rather unfashionable way for a new Administrative Procedure Act. And we do that because if we look at the Administrative Procedure Act from 1946, which sets out frameworks for how administrative agencies make decisions and how courts review them, that was preceded by the Attorney General's Committee report of 1941, which was a massive survey of how different administrative agencies made decisions. And so for us, an important part of the process is actually opening up expertise and saying, well, how is it making decisions? What is going on? Because for us, a lot of the problems have been created by the fact that, you know, people just don't engage with what goes inside these agencies. And trying to, you know, mount a law reform process which reflects the fact that since 1946, our administrative agencies and their expertise have changed. You know, they have evolved into something very different than they were then. And having a discussion and a debate about that, we think would be very healthy.
As a co-author, I'm equally optimistic, Rob. I'm not pessimistic, because one of the things you can see from your book and from much other work that's been done, which we tend to forget, is we've been here before.
That's a good point.
This is not the first time in our history we've had intense polarization. As Liz just indicated, it's certainly not the first time in the government that it hasn't been broke. In fact, it was far worse in terms of functioning under Andrew Jackson than it was now. And we've recovered. And the way we've recovered is through leadership and citizen activism, that political leaders arose who understood the problem, who could communicate it to the public, who could energize citizens for restoring government in a way that it'll do things and protect us, and carrying that message successfully to enough of the skeptical public that you once again build a majority for doing things in a way that respects truth and expertise. There's no reason to think that that's really changed. Trump is not the first leader we've had to play fast and loose with the facts. He may be the worst one, but he's certainly not the first one. Politics has been extremely vicious in the past. And yet, while all that was going on, these conversations about how do we do this better were proceeding. They just gradually grew and grew and grew and took over, and we had reform of the kind we're advocating for in the book. So when others will read this book, they're likely to say, Congress can't agree on anything. How in the world is it going to put out a new Administrative Procedure Act? And the answer is, well, yes, now, but we're looking ahead, and we see another one of these periods coming. And we can rebuild people's faith in government. For some people, it's not going to be possible, but there's a pretty sizable middle of the country that aren't that down on government and understand that truth is a real thing. We have to build a coalition with the people who understand that, and then things will get better.
Any advice for the everyday citizen?
Find out how the government decision makers who affect your lives make their decisions. It's slightly hard now because not everything is available on the internet that it once was, but understanding how decisions are made, I think, is incredibly important, would be my first piece of advice.
Join some cause, and if you don't have the time to contribute to it directly, well, then send in a little bit of money. There's a lot of us, and you don't need to send in very much money to make a difference if all of us do it, because we know from our history these things don't happen on their own, and they take a while. These periods of reform sometimes have taken a long time to get going. But the dam has broke before and it'll break again, but only if people do the two things that I think maybe we just mentioned.
Liz Fisher, Sid Shapiro, thanks for joining me on Connect the Dots.
Thank you for having us.
Well, that's our show. Visit our show page to find more information on my guests and the topics we discussed. You'll find that at www.progressivereform.org. I'm also really interested to hear about your reactions to this show and to any questions you might have about the topics that we've been dealing with this season. So at the end of our season, as I've said, we're going to have a special show just devoted to email that I received. So please send me a question about anything related to this show or previous shows, anything on health, safety, the environment. I'll have a guest on hand to help me answering those questions. So write. I'm at rob@progressivereform.org. Also, make sure to follow me on Twitter if you're a Twitter follower. Thanks again to the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. Thanks also to assistant producer Brian Gum. Our music today was performed by Kilo Kaz, and the theme music is by Lobo Loco. Take care.
You've been listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center working to build thriving communities on a resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website at www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.